back in the days before it all started, I was going my way like I'd always done. Now I'm looking around for my dearly departed, wandering these streets like I'm all alone. What are we doing? Are we getting back to normal? And we find ourselves out in the world again. What are we doing? Are we getting back to normal? And we find we're somewhere we ain't never been. I always believed the world had an answer, but now I think it, I've been thinking all wrong. The questions I had, well, I never really asked them. Truth is, I don't wanna know after all. What are we doing? Are we getting back to normal? And we find ourselves out in the world again. What are we doing? Are we getting back to normal? And we find we're somewhere we ain't never been. Yesterday, what are we doing? Are we getting back to normal? And we find ourselves out in the world again. What are we doing? Are we getting back to normal? And we find we're somewhere we ain't never been. What are we doing? Are we getting back to normal? Ourselves out in the world again. What are we doing? Are we getting back to normal? And we find we're somewhere we ain't never been. Yeah, we find we're somewhere we ain't never been. Yeah, we find we're somewhere we ain't never been.
That was Back to Normal by Jason Eady on the Hippies and Cowboys podcast. Welcome into the show. Hope you all are doing good out there. Jason Eady has an outstanding record coming out August 27th. That's this Friday, if you're listening to this episode, the week that it releases. The record is called To the Passage of Time, and it has a great story behind it from not only just the method in which it was recorded, but the method in which it was written as well, which you'll hear more about just shortly. We're brought to you by Workman's Relief CBD. Go to workmansrelief.com, fill up your cart, use our promo code HACCBD for 15% off at checkout. You can find our merch and everything else that's going on over on thehippiesandcowboys.com. Well, I guess not quite everything that's going on, because if you are a subscriber to our Patreon, for as little as $1 a month, you can customize your pledge. Pledge anything you want one time per month, and you'll gain access to all of the information as to what we have going on over at Hippies and Cowboys headquarters. You'll gain access to YouTube videos early before we drop them on YouTube. You'll have the opportunities to ask questions to our guests. And you'll get to tune in to a brand new show that we've been doing over on Patreon only. And that's always a good time. We get to talk a little more about current events. You'll learn a little bit more about us. And it's just generally a damn good time. All that and more at patreon.com/hippiesandcowboys. But I've posted the links to everything that you need to check out in the description to this podcast. So without further ado, let's dive right into episode number 113 with Jason Eady. Thanks for tuning in, everybody, and enjoy the show. Good enough. I'll figure it out.
That sounded fine. Yeah, it looked good.
you never know if you're actually going to get it right, because I mean, the Zoom call could lag. You never know.
Yeah.
It could be a delay. So we just have to wing it anyways.
Yeah.
Jason Eady, welcome to the show, man. Appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me on today. Yeah, excited about it.
Right. Yeah, it's on. Been man, you're one of the first like names in this genre of music that I was introduced to like back in the day, so it's an honor.
Oh, really?
To be on, man.
Yeah, that's cool. All right.
Yeah, it was like Turnpike Troubadours and then Charlie Crockett and you and Courtney Patton. And
wow,
it was like first initial swoop of music, because we don't get this music up in Iowa very often. It's hard to come by. So yeah.
When did you find Charlie? See, I was late to the Charlie game. I mean, I guess he's been doing it a while, and I did not know that for some reason. He just, like, slipped by.
Weird. I guess you could call me a late bloomer in this kind of music in general, because, like, in Iowa, like, I grew up, like, just with mainstream. That's pretty much all you get. And then I had a teammate in college show me Turnpike, and it would have been, like, 2016 or 15, maybe.
Yeah.
And I knew, he's like, trust me, man, like, let's just go to this concert. You're going to like it. And Charlie opened up for them.
So okay.
It was like kind of inadvertently Charlie got thrown in there. But yeah, it was so relatively recently, I guess, for how long this stuff's like, he's probably been around. But
yeah.
Charlie's also been cranking out records like at a crazy pace compared to everybody else, too. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's amazing. I love him. I was late to that train for some reason. I don't know why. He just, to me, it seemed like he came out of nowhere, but now I'm realizing he's been at it a while. He slipped by for some reason. You know, you do this long enough too, and you just, I don't know. You kind of quit paying as much attention as you used to, just because you're so lost in your own world, you know, which is not good.
There's so many, got to be so many names of people that you meet that are also musicians that are just like, how do you keep track of them and like, dig into them all? But I don't know. That makes sense. But you've been doing it for a while. This is what your
eighth record.
Eighth full length record.
Eighth record, yeah. Yeah. My first one was 05. So this is, 16 years. So yeah, I'm averaging about one every 2 years, I guess.
One every couple years.
Yeah.
Right on. Yeah. Put up like a batting average stat album.
Yeah, right.
Album average.
Uh-huh. Yeah, because I really would love to do one a year. I mean, that's the idea, but there's just so much to it, especially on the independent side of things. I mean, it's just, you know, you got to do all of it. So that's, you know, by the time you get one out, you've been working on it for a year, and the idea of just immediately starting another one can be a lot, especially when you got to go tour the one you just put out, you know. Yeah. But I would love to eventually figure out how to do one a year. That's kind of the goal.
You probably write enough songs to get one a year.
Yeah, I got the songs for it. It's more the finding the time and the energy and the focus, you know, to do it all. With the tour, the touring's what, if it weren't for touring, I mean, I would love to just make records all the time, but, which is why I made two last year. I recorded two records last year just because we had the year off. So that was cool. I kind of got ahead. I got one ahead. So maybe
got that average.
Maybe that'll help. Yeah, I got the average.
There you go.
Yeah.
I think I read there somewhere that you wrote most of this album in like 3 days or something like that last summer?
Yeah, it was about this time. And in fact, it might have been about this week. Like, I think it was the beginning of August last year in this room that I'm sitting in right now. And I wrote seven. I had kind of started writing around June, and I wrote four or five songs in that period. And then I wrote seven songs in that 3 day period. And then two of the first five that I did didn't make the record. They probably make the next one, but it was just a weird time. That's never happened before, but I do normally write in chunks like that. I mean, I'm a very I'm not an everyday writer for sure. I definitely I'm always gathering ideas and thinking about things, but I'm hardly, you know, I don't just sit down every day and try to write, but so I generally write in chunks like that, but usually it's, you know, I'll get a record done in a couple of months, that mm-hmm. kind of thing. But through 3 days is a little extreme, but I think it was just I think it was just being home and everything was just kind of pent up, and it was just the nature of last year, I think, is what did it.
Wow.
Now, you're in a situation that not many other musicians are in, where you live with a musician and are married to one.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, like, do you guys write together? Do you kind of do your own things and then like bring it to each other? Because I mean, you sing on each other's stuff all the time. I wonder. Mm-hmm. I'm always curious, like, do you guys write together?
You guys did an entire record in 2016, right?
Yeah. We don't write together as much. We definitely do our own thing. But what we do is we're definitely each other's critics and editors. Yeah. You know what I mean? As soon as I finish something, that's the first thing I do is play for her, and vice versa. You know, she does it for me. And so it's a really good, honest kind of feedback. Because sometimes when you write, you know, you think you're being clear and you think you've said everything, and then the other person hears it and they'll just go, I don't get it. You know, or that, like, you'll leave some big part of it out that you just had in the back of your mind and just assumed it would come through and it didn't, you know, stuff like that. So that's really, really, really helpful to have somebody that just as soon as you finish it can kind of give you some real honest, good feedback on it. But she did write. So when I got into that zone, it was really pretty cool because she realized what was happening. And so she kind of left me alone here in our room, you know, and just, she was bringing me dinner and, you know, bringing food and putting it outside the door kind of stuff. And, cause she, you know, she knew what it was and she didn't want to break that flow. So she just kind of stayed away and let it happen. And then on the third day I got stuck on Saturday night, that song, a song called Saturday Night. And she came in, and so she helped me finish that one up. So we did write that one together. That was the last one of the seven.
That's awesome. Wow. That's also a song that we're going to play cool. last on this episode. So.
That's pretty great that she recognized what was happening and that this wasn't a normal situation.
Yeah, right. Well, it's funny. She's there now. I mean, it's not to that extreme, but she's cranking them out. You know, it's weird how, you know, you just get – maybe it's that way for everything creative, probably is. But, you know, either – sometimes you just get in that flow and it just goes. And when it does, you better just – if it's your job, you better just drop everything else and – you know, and get at it. And so she's doing that these days. I mean, she'll stay up here and work on a song for hours, you know, and once I realize that's what she's doing, I just kind of leave her alone and let her do it. Cause if it was an on off switch, that would be nice, but it doesn't quite work that way. You know, you got to take it when it comes.
What was that like for you? Cause you said you kind of write in chunks mm-hmm. already, But what was it like in the middle of that after it had stretched into, you know, even 2 days at that point, even if you, even when you're about halfway through, knowing that if you turn that switch off and just kind of try to step back, that it, you may not be able to get back into it?
That's exactly what it was. So I wrote one, and then immediately just felt like it was going good. I wrote it pretty fast, and then wrote the next one, same thing, and then wrote a third one that first night. But I've done that before. I've done three before like that. And so I went to bed, I put the guitar down by the bed, and then the next morning I woke up and just thought, I wonder if it's still there, you know, and I grabbed it, grabbed the guitar, and immediately it happened again, you know, and so that's when it happened first thing that next morning, that's when I knew it was kind of something different, because it was still there after sleeping on it, you know, which normally that doesn't happen. So then that's when I thought, I better just ride this train till it ends, you know, because I don't know how far this is going to go. And it happened that whole second day. And then it kind of faded on that third day. I finished Saturday night. We finished it together. And then that was kind of the end of it, and I was spent. But I was very aware that it was going on, you know. Like I said, I mean, if I knew how to make that happen, I'd do it all the time. But unfortunately,
It sounds like you'd be burnt out at the end of that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I was pretty burnt out by the end. In fact, I didn't write again after that until like 3 months ago. So it's been, wow. I mean, I went about 9 months after that.
Wow.
Didn't write That's anything. Wild. Yeah.
Just for a lack of like material, or just like,
no, it's
you
just
were spent ambition. Still and you just needed to kind of take that step back.
Yeah, I just needed to take a step back. I don't know. I've tried the writing constantly, like writing everyday thing, and I know people that are really, really good at it, and that's their method. But for me, if I do that, everything gets real stale, and it'll just all start sounding the same, and I'll start saying the same things over and over again. Mm-hmm. So I'm really kind of a, you know, deplete the well and then give it some time to fill back up, and then, right, you know, flush it out again. But that's just how it works for me. It used to be something that I worried about. It's always been my process. I used to have a lot of guilt about it, those first couple records, because I thought I was supposed to be writing all the time, or I wasn't mm-hmm. doing my job, you know. And I would feel guilty when I'd go a while without doing it. But now I just understand that that's part of the deal. That's just what it is. Now, that doesn't mean I get to do nothing for 9 months. I mean, I'm still collecting and, you know, gathering ideas and writing stuff down and thinking about things and recording little snippets in my phone. I mean, I'm still doing it, but I'm just not actually sitting down, you know, with the idea that I'm going to finish something today.
I want to talk about, like, kind of the recording of the album itself, because that seems like a cool story.
Mm-hmm. Do you mind if I stick one more question on this,
yeah,
on this 3 day burst?
Yeah,
I'm curious about one more thing before we move on. I'm curious about one more thing, because as somebody who's not a songwriter, and for anybody listening to this who doesn't write songs, it's probably really, like, at least for me, it's really difficult to wrap your head around what that feeling must be like, and how that's really working in your head. And I don't even know if you'll be able to describe it to us that well, but are you, so you wake up on that second day, or you wake up on that third day, and you're like, is it still on?
Mm-hmm.
You sit down, what are you doing? Are you going back to those notes in your phone? And once you finish that one, when the next one falls out, like, are you still just going back to stuff, little snippets that you've recorded here and there of just ideas? Or are you being inspired by things that happened in the process of writing that last song? Like, how is that happening?
it's actually a combo of those two. So what I'll first do, and this is the way I start everything, first thing I do is just sit down and just start strumming the guitar and just kind of see where it goes, you know, whatever. I'm very rarely intentional about, like, I don't sit down and go, I want to write a slow song, or I want to write a whatever. I just kind of take the guitar and let it go where it goes, you know, and then a lot of times that'll lead to kind of these, like, this mumbling, you know, singing but not really singing words kind of thing. And then it'll get to a point where either something will start happening, something will start coming to me, and it'll go, or I'll go, I really like where this is going, I've got this thing that I wrote down 6 months ago that might go with that, and I go back and grab it. So it's kind of a combo of the two. But yeah, it's kind of a blending of those two things. But I'm not, I don't know if this is good or bad. I'm not I'm intentional, but I don't ever sit down and go, today I'm going to write a song about this very specific thing. You know, to me, that's the job of, that's where the collecting throughout the year comes in is that gives me those things to reference. But, you know, yeah, I hardly ever just, I don't think I could do the Nashville thing where there's go, you know, so-and-so's looking for a song about, you know, a truck with on the this day, you know what I mean? Like where it's very, very, I mean, they do, they get that specific with it, you know, and I don't think I'd be very good at that. I don't think I could tailor it quite that way. I'm jealous of people that can, I just definitely don't have that
if I'd be jealous
ability.
Of that.
Well, I know people. I know some guys that are really good at it, you know, and not the truck part.
Oh, okay,
I should
just
clarify
the
that
specific.
Just
part.
The being okay. able to okay. kind of to the being able to write about something very specific on demand. You know, that's yeah. Yeah, the truck was probably a bad
well,
reference.
Well, an accurate
but,
one.
Know, it is accurate,
that's
yeah.
That's funny. I'll get to the yeah. what I was going to dive into with the actual recording of the album because, I mean, it was obviously produced by Gordy Quist. So for listeners out there who maybe haven't listened to our episode with Band of Heathens, go listen to that. Got their little bag tag up here right now. But that's an awesome guy that awesome. To get in touch with for you and just listening through the album
yeah.
like the instrumentation is really awesome throughout it, like a good variety of everything going on, mandolin, pedals, mm-hmm. Fiddle, you know, it's definitely stands out as just a really well put together album in that regard too. And then it sounds like it was recorded on some pretty cool equipment too, so I don't know if you want to talk about kind of how the whole
it
album
very much
came
was.
Together in that way, but it seems like a really cool
yeah,
story.
Yeah, it's a great story. Yeah, it was just, I loved everything about the process. So I've known Gordy way before the Heathens. We met back in 2005. We were we were doing a folk festival together in North Texas, and that's where we met. And so we've been friends that long, you know, way back. And so I kind of knew him as a songwriter, as a singer-songwriter first, before the whole Band of Heathens thing happened. So in my mind, that's the Gordy that I met, you know. And so I've always thought about him that way. And I absolutely love the Heathens and what they do. You know, but to me, Gordy's got, there's two sides to that coin, you know, and he's great at both of them. But I knew from his singer-songwriter side that he would be a good person to get to do this. And we were originally talking about doing a record in April of last year, and it just wasn't going to work out. He had some other projects going on, and so I was going to go with somebody else. And then so one of the best things that happened during the shutdown is because I couldn't record in April, I had to delay it. By the time I got ready to record, his availability had opened up. And so that led to that. And so, yeah, we just, we had a lot of talks. He's very much into, vintage gear, which, you know, and it's, you can hear it on the album. I mean, it was one of the big selling points for me he's got a brand new studio. I was the first thing they did in there. And so that was fun too, because they were kind of figuring it all out, you know. And
yeah.
But I mean, everything's tube amps. You know, hardly anything's digital at all. It's all goes through an analog board. The only thing we didn't do analog was we didn't go to tape. You write at the last second. It bypassed the tape part. But other than that, I mean, everything that was recorded was old. You know, 1970s. Or earlier, you know, vintage gear with real tubes and really warm, real warm sounding
yes.
stuff, you know. And the engineer, Jim Valentine, who did the engineering, he actually builds, he has a company that builds those tube preamps like that. So that's his specialty anyway. And so they just together, they know how to make those sounds, you know. And then they were, they had a guy come into their studio before I got there that that his whole job is to do, I guess it's acoustic engineering, but you know, the guy like measures the room and makes sure that, you know, there's this much. So wow. it's not just the microphone. It's where you sit in the room, you know, makes the difference, you know? And so, wow. It was just a lot of really cool stuff like that. I mean, they're very much, audiophiles, you know, I mean, I loved it. It was, and we tracked live. I mean, we didn't overdub anything. So everything you hear happened in real time. And so,
beautiful.
And so I was hearing that, like what you're hearing on the record is what I was hearing in my headphones as it was happening, you know, and I knew how rich it was sounding and how full it was sounding, you know, and so that part of it was great. My favorite part about it is we had a lot of conversations before we recorded, and one thing we decided to do that I've never done before. Sometimes records can get away from you because you write them like they're acoustic. I write them with an acoustic guitar in my room. I play most of my shows acoustic. I really like the singer-songwriter thing. That's kind of where I live, you know. And so you get in there with the band, and all of a sudden there's a drummer and a bass player, and there's all these things, and it can go in a place that you didn't – like the momentum kind of takes it somewhere more than a conscious decision. It's kind of just this is where the momentum of the day takes you. And so you end up with something that you like, but it's not necessarily what you set out to do. And so this time what I wanted to do this time was I went in and I started the songs, every single song. I started it acoustic on my acoustic guitar, and the band sat in the control room. They couldn't even come in the room. They were in the control room, and nobody was allowed to play on it unless they heard a part. You know what I mean? So instead of starting with everybody and pulling things out, it was the opposite. You had to kind of raise your hand and go, I think I could do this here. And then, of course, when we did the final take, we had worked all that out. And so there are times where there's instruments in the intro, but that's because it was like that was take three or whatever after we had worked through all of that. But getting to that point was every time, and some of them, what you hear on the record, it was that first take, and you can hear it. You can hear it starts with me, and then you can hear things. Yeah. There's a song called These Things. I think it's track number 2. And you can hear it on that one for sure. It's just, and I think that one happened. I think that was pretty real time. I mean, it just starts me, and you can kind of hear everybody sneak in. But we really wanted to do that. We wanted every note that was played on this record to be a conscious decision that we made. You know, not just because somebody was in the room and they needed to play. You know, it was everybody, and which also takes a very special kind of musician to, you know, to let their ego go, and there's a lot of songs that people sat out on. You know, there's a couple that the drummer didn't go in, and there's a couple that the bass player didn't play on. I mean, it just it was a really great group of guys because they really took that seriously and thought about the songs and didn't need to play just for the sake of playing. You know, they were really good about that. So that was kind of my favorite part was. You know, we crafted every note collectively as a group. You know, we crafted every note on that record. So that's a pretty special thing. I've never recorded like that before. But honestly, I don't know that I'll do it any other way from now on. I'm pretty sold on it.
That's so cool. It's funny because it's like pretty much speaks to exactly what I had written in my notes about the instruments really letting between the method and the equipment, like. From what you just said, like my comment was the instruments really let your voice and the stories be at the forefront. Nothing is there that should not be there when it comes to like the mandolin and the dobro. And that just perfectly addresses that comment.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, that's good that you picked up on it because that's what we were going for. It's a lyric record, 100%. It's a lyric album. I love those Guy Clark records because, you know, Guy, he toured acoustic. If you ever saw him, you know, 9 times out of 10, he was playing acoustic. And it was a solo show, or he had Verlin Thompson with him, you know. But it was a real stripped down show. But his records were not. They had a whole band on all of his records, but it didn't. there wasn't a disconnect between those. You know what I mean? What you heard, you could hear the album, even though there was a whole band on it, and go see him solo, and you didn't feel like you were losing anything in translation, you know? And I really have always been, I've always been in awe of how to pull that off.
Speaking on the lyrical part of the album, one song that really highlights that would be French Summer Sun. And it just so happens to be the middle song that we're playing on this episode. So I don't know if you want to give
I have to jump in here because on Patreon, shameless plug to our Patreon, all of our patrons can ask questions to our guests. And so we had a question come in specifically about this song because it has a pretty cool story behind it, and it's a really captivating song, and it's in a story in its own right. And so this come in from Trisha McCauley. So thank you, Trisha, for the great question. She says, French Summer Sun, then obviously there'll be some spoilers here, but you can answer this one and kind of lead from that into the introduction and the story behind this one. But she says, French Summer Sun, what was it like standing on the beach your grandfather fought on? What other thoughts came to you aside from the lost generations? She puts in quotes.
That is a great question. That's where the whole song started, was that standing on that beach. I'd heard about it. It's Anzio Beach in Italy. Even though we called the song French Summer Sun, and you know, it just, at a certain point, you're just writing the song. But it came from, you know, it's about this beach in Italy. It's south of Rome, and it was a big battle, and it's a big part of my family story because my grandfather fought there, and I just always heard it my whole life, and so finally got down there, and I had the idea of, you know, if things had gone differently, then I wouldn't be there, and you know, that's a big part of it. But if the question is what else was going through my mind, that a big thing that I realized there was that beach was tiny. That was the thing that got me more than anything. Because I've been to Normandy, and the thing about Normandy is exactly the opposite. It's so big that you realize what a distance they had to cover, you know, and how dangerous that was, and just the idea of having to go from one part to the other is pretty. Well, this one was exactly the opposite of that. I think there were about 30,000 soldiers trapped on this beach, and they were pinned down from the top with the Germans and Italians had pinned them on this beach, and it was just the scope of how tiny it was, and they were stuck there for about 6 months, I think, and I think a third of them, I think 10,000 people died or something. And my grandfather even had stories of two or three different people that he shared foxholes with died next to him, you know, in the foxholes. It was that close. And just the idea that, I think that's kind of where the song really started, was that thought of how tight that was, you know. And it wasn't just a matter if he had made a wrong move. I mean, it literally was like, if he was 3 inches this way versus 3 inches that way, you know, he might have not made it. And that's really where the push, where the idea came from, was just those conditions. I didn't expect it to be that small. And so there was just no room for error on that beach, you know, and that's really where the song came from. Right. I just can't imagine, you know, I can't imagine living like that. And he was there the whole 6 months. When it was over, he actually went AWOL because it was such a – and I think a lot of them did. I think it was just such a horrible 6 months, and he kind of roamed Europe for a while and finally just met back up with his unit. And when he did, they were going to court-martial him, and they did. They brought him up in front of the judge and everything, and then he said they asked him, you know, to defend himself, and he just said he had spent all 6 months at Anzio, and they – immediately dismissed it and sent him back to his unit. And you know, they just, it was like, okay, you get a pass on that one, you know. It was that kind of battle. But it was just pretty incredible to see. I'm glad I finally saw it. It took me a long time, but that was back in 2018, and so I had the idea for that for 2 years, but it was just one of those ideas that it was kind of too big for me, you know. It was almost intimidating I wanted to get it right, and it just was a little bit intimidating. So I finally called Drew Kennedy last spring, and this was cool. We actually had two or three conversations about the song before we ever wrote the song. I mean, we would just have 20, 30-minute talks about the idea and the concept of it before we ever even tried to write it. So when we sat down to write it, I think it took 20 or 30 minutes to actually write the thing. But that's because I kind of joke that the song took 2 years and 30 minutes to write. You know, there was a lot that went into those 30 minutes. That one is kind of, production wise and the feel on the song, it's kind of what I said about the other part of it, times 10. I mean, because in every part of that process, there wasn't anything we could do that added anything to it. You know, we even tried, I mean, we didn't intend to write a spoken word song. It was supposed to have a melody, and every melody we wrote took away from the words. You know, everything we did, everything we tried to do to it made a distraction rather than adding to it. And so, even in the studio, we tried putting some cello on it. We tried some different things, and everything we did took away from it. So it was like the only thing that really gave it its full impact was just, I mean, a stripped down, you know, speaking the words, playing one, you know, just a solo acoustic guitar. It just, that was what worked. And everything else we did really distracted from the lyric. And so it was, that was a really interesting process to watch that song evolve, because you're tempted the whole time I've never done a spoken word song ever. I've never even come close to it. It honestly was a little uncomfortable at first to get used to doing that, you know, but it's what it was. It's what the song needed. And there wasn't really any way around it other than forcing something right. That wasn't there, you know? So it's just that song kind of wrote itself, but the production side of it kind of did. It kind of dictated its own terms, you know?
We heard the quiet buzzing of a fly. For a second, he wasn't quite sure what it was. Till it tickled his face and he opened his eyes on a beach in the French summer sun. Sulfur in the air and the smell of something worse. He leaned up on his elbow and looked around. Wiped some blood from his face and saw his buddy James mangled, torn apart on the ground. Well, the medics got to him and he thanked God they did. He spent 27 days in a field hospital before making the slow trip home to the States, minus one leg, which still seemed impossible. He got a job sorting mail in the Birmingham post office, 5 days a week, enough pay to get by. He met a beautiful girl through a mutual friend, and 11 months later, that girl was his wife. Well, the nightmares were often and so vivid and real. He'd wake up screaming a few times a week. She was patient and kind, stayed by his side, and in time, he found a more restful sleep. And by the next year, they had him a son. Got drafted when he turned 18. He went off to fight, but he came back whole. Met my mom, and they had me. And I come from a long line of soldiers. Their blood still flowing through me. And they fought in fields and foreign lands so I could be who I wanted to be. Well, I broke the streak and I went to college instead of Kabul or Kuwait. Got my degree and I got hired to teach Shakespeare and Wordsworth and Yeats. At a decent-sized high school outside of Atlanta, did the best that I could. Yeah, that's heady stuff for kids that age. But all in all, I think I did some good. And I come from a long line of soldiers whose blood still flowing through me. And they fought in fields and foreign lands so I could be who I wanted to be. Heard the quiet buzzing of a fly. For a second he wasn't quite sure what it was, till it tickled his face and he opened his eyes, and then he died there in that French summer sun. And that girl he would have met sorting mail back in Birmingham, she met a lawyer and they fell in love. So their story ends before it began, on that beach in the French summer sun. And that child she had, well, that wasn't my dad, and I wasn't ever his son. So my story ends before it began, on that beach in the French summer sun. And I come from a long line of soldiers whose blood flowed into the sea. War took more than just one life. It took him and his son and me.
So, Jason, one thing that stands out, just like following your music through the years here, and we talk about community quite a bit, especially like when we're like with our Kentucky artists that we have on. But you seem to have a pretty good community of, like, other artists. Like, obviously we talked about, like, Courtney, but it seems like you guys have quite an awesome friend group down there. Like, Jamie Lynn Wilson comes to mind right away. And that just seems unique. I don't know, it stands out for whatever reason. But I don't know if you want to talk about, like, what that's like and how kind of fellow musicians down there kind of impact you, and how, I don't know, like just the relationships there seem really awesome. But
yeah, it's a very real thing, and it's one of my favorite things, and I feel incredibly lucky to play music down here. It's just I meet people from other scenes sometimes, and they're kind of, they can't believe that it's, that it really does work. They kind of think it's maybe an act, you know, but it's really, I mean, it's really not. I mean, we've all, there's a group of us that have been doing this for 15 years together, and we've gone through all of it, you know, ups and downs. And I went and wrote with Jamie a few weeks ago, and we were having this conversation, and you know, that I mean, we really do, the same way that Courtney and I run songs by each other, we do that with each other too. You know, as soon, I'll play a song for Courtney, but then I'll send it to three or four people, you know, and get their feedback on it. And just, and it's an incredibly supportive community. There's just not the competition part. There's healthy competition, you know, there's definitely that, which is good. I mean, there's somebody does something and you want to keep up, you know, there's that kind of competition, which is good. I mean, it pushes all of us, but, mm-hmm. But there's not a cutthroat kind of competition. Nobody's trying to beat the other person, you know, or make bad things happen or anything like that. I mean, it's very real, very supportive, and everybody's always trying to get each other. And we'd call and trade notes on venues, and you know, you should play here, and don't play here, you know, those kinds of things. And I know that the Kentucky scene has it too. I mean, I've dabbled there just enough to really to see that, and it's kind of the only other place I've ever really seen it that feels like the Texas thing. You know, it does feel that way up there too. You know, but it's not just Texas. I don't know how to describe it. Core Blund is part of our, you know, he does all the things we do and all the festivals and everything that we're, you know, he's part of that. And, Trey Hensley, Channing Wilson, they're out of Nashville, yeah. and Brent Cobb, you know, it's not just localized to Texas. I mean, even though that's where it's centered, but I don't know, there's just a culture and that a group, you know, we've all just kind of found each other and it's really, it's just really been it's very real, very genuine. That's not a, it's not something that is a put on. I mean, it really does work that way. And I don't know if I'd have been able to stick with it this long without that. Cause it's hard. I mean, this independent route it's hard, man. I mean, you know, I'm on year 16 and I think I would consider myself successful in the last five, you know, like really to the point where I don't worry about whether I'm going to be able to do this for a living. You know what I mean? I mean, that's a fairly recent thing for me. It's 10 years of, oh man. I mean, it's you know, without that kind of support group, I don't know how you do that, to be honest. I mean, it's the only way I think we've all gotten through it is just having each other to push each other through it.
That's a good insight too. Yeah, that's a great point. I don't know. I just, you see it like, I don't know. It all seems so genuine and like you guys just seem like great pals down, you know, that's why I also didn't say Texas too, is cause like, yeah, you know, that community, like that tight knit group of like you guys is not like limited to Texas, but kind of, yeah, like you said, centralized there. But yeah, that's cool hearing you talk about it. On that note though, we are going to put you through our infamous rapid fires. And
okay, all right, let's see
if you have made it out alive.
Okay.
I'll start you off with easy one. You talked about venues there a bit, and I had a venue question.
Okay.
Ready. You know, so I've asked people before, like, what's their least favorite venue to play, but then it's kind of, like, hard to say because you don't want to say names and, like, throw. Some people are like, no, fuck this place.
But, yeah.
You know, some people are like, I don't want to say, you know. So what is your favorite venue
to play?
And I say this because, like, a couple of times you've been down to Mile Zero, and right? Or just the one? Maybe just once. But no, a couple of times. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've done all of them.
That's one that's like a bucket list of mine, but it's always like during school for me. But it looks like it's like cold here, and then I see like you playing on a stage and on a beach in South Florida, and it's like, dang. So I'm just curious what your favorite venue has been over the 16 years.
I love Knuckleheads in Kansas City. I kind of think of that as, even though it's 8 hours away, I think of it as my home bar. I mean, the owner there has been, I went through there, God, I mean, in 05, and he booked me for no reason. I had no business being up there, you know, and I went in and nobody showed up, literally nobody showed up. And he had me back, and I mean, for years and years, I couldn't get 10 people to show up, and he just kept having me, and he kept putting me on opening shows and on different things. And he's got so many different rooms there. There's four different stages, and so you can kind of create the show that you want. You know, there's the songwriter room, and then the middle room, and then the big outdoor venue. And I just love everything about it. I love that Frank Hicks is the guy's name that runs it. And I mean, he came to our wedding. He's that kind of friend, you know. I just love that venue. I think it's definitely the one that.
That's awesome. It's only a couple hours up the road from me, and it's actually a venue I've been to before. So that's, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's great. It's really cool. I love the Southgate House in Newport, Kentucky. It's an old church from the 1800s that you play in the old renovated sanctuary. You know, I mean, it's got a bar in it now. It's not a church, but it's got the stained glass and the whole thing. And, you know, that room's pretty great. Mile Zero is great. I love those festivals. Those festivals, you talk about the community. There's that one. There's Music Fest up in Steamboat Springs. There's one in Idaho, the Braun Brothers reunion up there. And those are kind of like reunions for us. You know, I mean, as close as this community is, we don't really see each other that much. We're all touring in different directions. So it's like those are kind of we have these three or four touch points through the year, you know, that we all get to see each other. So those things get pretty nuts because it's people you talk to on the phone all year and you might run into them here and there, but it's the only time that we're all together in one place. So
it's the same way for fans there too. Like it seriously is. Cause like, I mean,
you know,
people, like I said before, like people up here don't necessarily know this music or this scene near as well as they would in Texas or Oklahoma or Kentucky or, you know, like Iowa's. It's hard to get people turned on to it up here. It's hard for people to find out about it. But then you go to a festival and it's like a reunion of everybody that's around you that also listens to this music. And it's like a very rare thing for fans to like get to, like, it's a very similar thing. It's just cool to talk to a bunch of people that also like the same music as you. Cause that doesn't happen outside of that really. But
yeah, right. Cool. Yeah. Those are great. Those are great. As far as my least favorite, I do have an answer for that. There's a place it's so bad. It's in East Texas. I don't even know if it's still around. It's called Lunkers, and the place is so bad that the band would any gig from that point on that was a bad gig, called it a Lunker because this place was so bad. It was the milestone of bad gigs. I don't know if they're still around or not. Yeah, right.
Oh my god! That might count for that might have to count for two answers, two rapid.
I only did it once, but I remember it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
All right. What's your favorite flavor of chicken wings?
I like the what's the one, like lemon? Is it lemon pepper?
Lemon pepper.
Yeah, classic. I like that. Yeah, pretty. I'm a kind of classic guy on that stuff. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Can't go wrong with lemon pepper, dude.
I think Garrett's got another one here, right? Because he did. Yeah, I think so.
I got to do two in a row now? Okay. All right. What's if you can narrow it down, what sticks out as one of your favorite lines that you've ever written?
Oh, that's a hard one, man. That's a hard question.
Man, that's
a tough one.
Yeah, that's a tough one. That's a tough one. In the spirit of this record, I will tell you the one that's because I'm just thinking.
Sure,
my head's in new record mode right now. But there's a line on this record that kind of sums up the whole album to me, and it's because the whole theme of the album is, it's called "To the Passage of Time," which is the title of a song on there, which is me writing a letter to time, you know. And so every song on the record, in one way or another, is kind of me dealing with time passing and, you know, and kind of getting into the learning how to get into the flow with time and move with it instead of trying to push against it, you know, and control things too much. I'm really trying to get to a place where it just kind of move with things more. And there's a line in that song, called "To the Passage of Time," that says, I'm talking to time, and it says, I still remember when I thought you were my friend. You made me feel like it never would end. But now I'm older and I finally see that you're a little indifferent to me. And to me, that sums up the whole album. You know, that we kind of have this idea that like the world is here to serve us, you know, and it's here to bend to our will. And I don't, well, obviously last year is a perfect example of how that's not true. You know, it's kind of up to us to find that common ground, you know, in that place. And so right now, that's of this album, that's the line, or I guess that's a little verse really, but it really sums up what that whole record is to me.
You mentioned time a few times in there. I'll throw in a time question. If you could travel through time, would you rather go back or like to the past or to the future? And specifically, like, what year would you go to in the past, or how far into the future?
Man, that is a great question. I'm a history nerd. I mean, I love it. It's kind of my hobby is history stuff. And when I travel, that's what I do. But I'm going to say the future, because I'm such a history guy. I love seeing what turns into what leads to what. But so I would love to know what this is going to turn into. You know, I'd love to see the results, the future history. You know, I'd love to see that and what that is. I don't know. I think like 100 years, because I think, man, if you were around in 1921 and you got transported to now, it would blow your mind. I mean, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just a whole different world. And so I just can't imagine what 2121 is going to, you know, is going to look like. I just can't even comprehend it. I mean, even in my lifetime, I mean, I can't, you know, what, God, I think back, I mean, I was a kid, you know, this is old man stuff, you know, but I mean, I do, you know, I remember, you know, having three channels on TV and that was it. Whatever was on those three is what you watched. And now it's like, you know, immediate entertainment at your fingertips. And, you know, we get mad if it takes 5 seconds for the page to load, you know. So just, you know, if it's come that far in 40 years, I mean, what's it going to be in 100? It's just, it's like almost
exponential growth of technology. So, do you think
that's so true?
There will ever be time travel? No.
No. Oh. I don't. I'm a, this is an, man, I'm revealing a lot here. I'm also, I love history. I'm also really into science stuff right now because it's always been my weakest. I've never been into science. And so I always fluffed off on that, you know, my whole life. And now I'm trying to catch up. And so I believe it or not, I've actually been studying that kind of thing a lot lately. And I think that they've pretty much proven that it can't be done. You know, that it's just kind of an impossible. Not to mention the whole the grandfather paradox. You know, if you went back and, you know, kept your grandparents from getting married, how could you be there to do that? You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. And then, but there's also it's just impossible. I mean, it would take going faster than light.
I've heard the theory too, where it's like if time travel is ever
real, true though.
Well, it's either not real or we live in a very boring era of time because nobody's coming to visit. Like
nobody's coming back.
All right? Yeah. One thing I do think is maybe possible is the idea that it's all kind of happening at once. I think that reality is maybe not that. I think there's some truth to that, you know, that we're seeing it from our little perspective of where we are in space and time, but, you know, that it's all kind of already happened and already is all happening at once. I really think there might be something there, but I don't think we will ever have the chance to see it.
There's some good scary movies with that premise. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Haunting of Hill House. It's not a movie.
Right, I got one more. Oh, it's a silly one. What's?
Oh yeah, I can see it.
There you go. You even have an example. What's the grossest thing you've ever seen someone eat like it's normal?
Oh man. Well, you know, I'm kind of the guy that likes to try the different foods. So it's probably
You're
me.
You're the culprit.
Yeah, I probably am the culprit, I think. I love traveling and so if it's a local thing and people eat it, I generally will try it.
Give it a try.
But so yeah, I don't know. It's probably been stuff. I've had lamb brains before. That was probably pretty probably the most extreme thing I've ever done. So yeah, me, I guess, is the answer to that. Hey, this one becomes full circle. I had a tour manager one time that her tolerance to spice it's nothing I've ever seen before. And we were up in Buffalo at this place called Barbill. And it's a place that it's kind of home of the chicken wing, the buffalo wing. Right. And they, after the show one time, they gave us a private tasting, you know, of all their wings. And they gave us the hottest one, and I couldn't see for like 30 minutes after I ate it, you know. But our but our tour manager, she ate it like it was candy and asked if they had anything else, and they said they did, but it was a special. They called it the suicide or something. And,
oh my god,
she ate it, and she ate it like, again, her expression was like it was candy, but it was so hot that her nose started bleeding. And
oh my god.
she didn't react to it. I mean, she didn't act like there was pain there, but it was
aside from the blood coming out of her.
yeah, that's probably the most extreme food thing that's I've ever seen in my life. I've never seen anything like it. I mean,
don't get me wrong, I can handle some spice, but that's, I don't get that, you know, the suicide death sauce, all this
right.
it's like okay, come on, you're not even enjoying that anymore. Well, I mean maybe she was, I guess.
I don't know.
She said
she did.
Maybe it tasted good.
Yeah,
I don't know. She's got to be missing some sort of receptor somewhere, you know. But that's the most extreme thing I think I've ever witnessed with my food wise.
But hey, you made it to the rapid fire. They're not very rapid. They're just goofy.
Oh man. But you made it through.
Oh, cool. All right. Well, good.
They're not very rapid. And shit, I mean, you pretty much made her all the way through the podcast here. We can pretty much wrap things up, I think.
All right.
Another victim for the hippies and cowboys.
we did it again. Another podcast.
How many have y'all done?
This will be...
recorded? This, out of recorded episodes, this is probably like 112.
Okay.
112, yeah. Something like that. Really? Yeah. Not including the ones that...
haven't aired.
Are never going to be put out.
Oh, okay.
There's probably four or five more of those, honestly, at this point. But yeah, so a couple, I guess. We're working on it.
Well, cool. Yeah, that's great.
Thanks so much for doing this. Yeah. And where can I guess give everybody the plug where they can go follow you on social media and all that good stuff and keep up with what you got going on. And then of course, if you've got pre-orders for the vinyl or whatever, I don't know. Again, I don't know when this is going to come out. So whether it's out now or where they can go buy a record and support you and go catch a show, I guess, in the next month or two.
Yeah. So all that info, jasonedy.com is the go-to spot. It's got all of the tour dates and it's got the link to my Instagram, jasonedy, Facebook, jasonedy music. So all of those things are great places to keep up. I do have one thing that I would love to talk about as far as that goes. Yeah. I'm starting a thing called, I'm just calling it The Club, and it's a subscription service for people that want kind of more behind the scenes or more, you know, in-depth stuff of what I'm doing. And so I'm starting that up, and what we're doing, we're actually going to launch it this week. The idea is if you go and you subscribe for a year, if you do the annual subscription, you'll get the new record when it comes out. You'll get a vinyl. You'll get the digital copy about a week before the album comes out. You'll have access to everything I've ever recorded before. And then the part I'm really excited about is also once a month, I'm going to put out a song to anybody that's a member of that group. That's an unreleased track in some way, whether it's just a track I've never released or an acoustic version of something I've recorded before, or sometimes it might be a cover song or it might be a brand new song that I've just written. But in some way, every month there'll be a track that'll go to that group that won't go anywhere else in the world. It won't be released anywhere else. It'll just go to that group. So,
nice.
So that's kind of what we're hoping is people, and you know, cause we're doing pre-orders for the vinyls, through the website. And, of course, you can always buy anything through the merch store, but I'm really hoping people will take that option and be part of the bigger, community on that. I think it'll be fun.
That's awesome. Yeah.
So cool. Yeah. It's great. It's great you're doing that. Absolutely.
Well,
I guess that's about it then, man. We can, we'll wrap things up. We're going to leave everybody with, Saturday Night is going to be the last song. This is the one that you talked a bit about earlier that you needed a little bit of help to finish during your big 3-day burst of creativity.
That's right. She got the cyst. Yeah.
There you go. But thanks for coming on the podcast, man. It was a lot of fun talking to you, and it was great to hear, really dig into this record and hear all about the process and the recording and everything. Really appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. It's been fun.
I don't know if you want to finish things off by, again, telling us a little story about Saturday nights and yeah, we can wrap things up. Thanks, man.
Yeah. So Saturday night, you know, I kind of touched on earlier about how long it takes to get going in the business, you know, and so this is, that song's just a direct result of that. You know, it's just when you're getting started, there's a ton of nights of just playing to the bar staff. I mean, that happens a lot, you know, where you just, you know, it's not just hoping that you have a good crowd. It's hoping that you have a crowd at all, you know, that anybody shows up. And sometimes they don't. And you just end up playing to either the locals that are just there anyway, or to the bartenders, which happens a lot. So it was just kind of a song, you know, it's probably the lightest song on the record content wise, but it's also one of my favorite tracks on the album. I love the feel of it. I love what the band did on it. It's a one chord song, which I've always wanted to do. I've never pulled that off before. I've gotten close. I've had songs that are technically one chord, but like little weird variations of the chord that make it not so much a true one chord song, but this one's full on same chord all the way through. I mean, there's a lot of stuff that I really like about it, but the idea is just kind of going back to those nights when you just play into an empty room and now looking back on it, it was kind of cool to get to do that. I was ready for it to be over in the moment, but, you know, I'm glad I went through it. It was good.
Sitting in a corner table all alone. There's a man keeps staring at his telephone. You can hear the cars rolling by, that ain't right. It's quiet around here for Saturday night. Well, there's a jukebox playing the same old song. We've been listening to all night long. It's a 10:45, hadn't been a fight. It's quiet around here for Saturday night. It's quiet around here for Saturday night. Jenny's cleaning up and back behind the bar. Junior made his move, but he didn't get far. Yeah, she's heard it all before, so she shut him down tight. Yeah, it's quiet around here for Saturday night. They got me set up in the corner and it's time to play. Jenny pulls a shot and then I take the stage. She likes to move to my groove when the crowd is light. It's quiet around here for Saturday night. It's quiet around here for Saturday night. Play up to the minute that they close it down. I look across the room, ain't nobody around.
Jenny says, come on, and she turns out the light. Yeah, it's quiet around here for Saturday night. Yeah, it's quiet around here for Saturday night. Yeah, it's quiet around here. Yeah, it's quiet around here. Yeah, it's quiet around here for Saturday night.